couple senators who are away and will not be with us today, but they will receive all the information, needless to say. The second thing I want to make clear that we have a new commission member today. It's Representative Kathy Brainerd, who is taking the place of Representative Kim Norton. And so we are pleased to have the addition of Representative Brainerd. As you probably know, that we haven't met for quite some time. We were trying to get schedules together, and it's been pretty challenging from that vantage point. Nonetheless, today's going to be a substantive and very informative time, and it will also create an opportunity for you as members to, you know, ask questions as the update comes forward. So before we get to our updates, one of the things that we talked about was a vice chair and a vice chair coming from the House. And so I want to vote and for us to vote on the nomination for vice chair. Do we have any nominations?
Sorry.
So nominations are open. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to nominate Representative Kathy Brainerd as vice chair.
All right. Any other nominations? Any other nominations? All right. I believe that we should do this. Well, nominations are closed, and we should probably do a roll call vote for that nomination, unless we just always just approve that nomination. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those who oppose say nay. Motion carries. Our new vice chair is Kathy Brainerd. You want to say a couple words?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I would just like to thank the members for their confidence. I see my role here. I'm as one among equals. I will serve as a liaison to the House members on issues of process and scheduling so that we have a voice at the table. But I think among us, we will continue, each of us, to work on behalf of the people of Minnesota in a strong oversight role with the authority.
Thank you, Representative Brainerd. And again, we are so excited about your addition to this committee and as well as becoming our vice chair. One thing I would like to amend the agenda in order to do, which is to approve the meeting minutes from last meeting. Did anyone have an opportunity to take a read of those minutes, and is there anyone who would make a motion on the minutes?
I move the minutes, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. Representative Atkins moves the adoption of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. The meeting minutes have been adopted.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, before we move on, I assume now we're going to get into the substantive portions of the agenda.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question. I notified the committee when this was set up a week ago that, in fact, I think Representative Hoppe and I are on the same panel with the Minnesota Realtors at 2:30. So we'll be leaving early. I just wanted to make sure that we talked a little bit about, as long as we're on the minutes and sort of the logistical things, about when we're meeting. Notices of meetings that come out a week ahead. I mean, it's been over 6 months now. I think the original meeting was in April, and we haven't met since then. We've got a $1 billion project before us that we're supposed to be providing oversight for. And it would be nice to get that monthly meeting schedule or whatever we're going to have, so it's not every 6 months. I think we owe the people of Minnesota a little bit more frequency. And I've been asking since June for that meeting schedule and when we're going to meet. And for the sake of all of our credibility as well as the branch of government that we represent, it'd be nice to have a brief discussion, perhaps, if it's all right with you, Mr. Chairman, about getting on a regular meeting schedule so that we can get it on our calendars and do the job that we've been assigned to do.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. That's well taken. And in order to demonstrate our understanding of that concern, you see that we do have scheduled upcoming meeting on the agenda as well. One thing that has proven true, trying to get calendars together any other way with electeds is like herding cats. And so I just want to make sure that we are respectful and that we get everyone's calendar and their input involved. And so we will definitely do that before we leave today.
And I'm just afraid that Representative Hoppe and I both leaving. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And your co-chair is not present, nor is Senator Housley, is that we might want to have a little bit of discussion about how frequently, perhaps. I mean, a meeting every 6 months right now. I'm getting more information out of the Pioneer Press and Charlie Walters than I am from this Oversight Committee. And that's not a good spot to be in, other than for the Pioneer Press. I just pitched them, I guess, to all kinds of people. And I read the Star Trib as well, but as well as my
local
paper.
But we see you frequently quoted
in the Southwest Review.
Shoveled on.
It just gets worse and worse.
Argo Forum.
But so with that being said, we understand your point again. And so we will have some time, and that's why I want to move expeditiously through the through the agenda if possible, so we can provide an opportunity for the authority to give us their update and then to get some reaction from the Vikings. And we want to do that before you have to leave. So I think it would make sense for us to provide the opportunity for us to go forward.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if I can make my little pitch, I'd suggest at least at this point a meeting once a month with $1 billion at stake in this investment, I think, at least for the period of time moving forward, that speaking just for myself, I don't know where the discussion will lead for others, but it seems with that kind of money at stake, we should probably be meeting more frequently than the once every 6 months that we've had to date.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I appreciate that this is on the schedule of the agenda and that we ought to move along in the agenda today instead of continuing to talk about this now. So that we can get through the rest of the agenda and get to this subject.
I concur. So with that being said, we will have Michelle Kelm-Helgen from the Stadium Authority come forward and welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And while she's getting settled, I'd just like to preempt some things. The Stadium Authority and the Vikings have been doing a lot of negotiation, and I know that some are sleep-deprived. And so I want to make sure that we recognize that as we get all the information from the authority. So with that being said, Ms. Kelm-Helgen.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here today. As we look at giving an update of where we are in the project, it's obviously somewhat timely in that we are getting close to finalizing the agreements that we're actually going to be looking at and voting on at our board meeting tonight. However, I do just want to be clear that I literally, as one of the negotiators, left negotiations. We still have a couple of outstanding issues, so things are not finalized. So to the extent there are questions about the agreements, I'm going to have to hold off because I honestly couldn't say until we're entirely done what's in those agreements. They will, however, our meeting is at 5 o'clock tonight, and we will be done by 5. And the documents will be posted at least in draft form on our website at 5 o'clock as our meeting starts. So anyone who wants to get a pre-look at that can do that at 5 o'clock. That being said, I believe the last time I was here, I went through kind of an update on the building itself and its design and construction. So if there are any specific questions related to the construction and the design of the building, you can let me know. And I actually have some of that on the PowerPoint, but I don't plan to go through it because I think we've already done that. So I don't want to waste people's time looking at things that they probably have already heard about. So, as I mentioned, just by way of update, we've got the board meeting at 5 o'clock tonight. And at that point, our board will be reviewing and approving both the stadium use agreement, which really is our lease with the Vikings, their lease for the new stadium, along with the development agreement, which really outlines the details of the financing arrangements for the team, and many of the sort of interrelated financial agreements between the team and the authority. So I think a very good follow-up meeting to this would be, if you're ever interested in coming, I can definitely provide a detailed walkthrough and update and answer questions about those agreements whenever it is that you want to take a look at those. The one thing specifically that I was asked to focus on, and I believe that the copies of the report are in your packets, is the due diligence work that was done on the part of the authority as we looked at our mission, your legislation very specifically called for a due diligence process that would be done to determine that the Vikings, the team, and the family, as they move forward, in fact, had the resources available to make good on their $477 million commitment. As I think everyone knows, at the same time, about 6 weeks ago maybe, there was the court case that the Wilf family had been involved in related to real estate holdings in New Jersey. And with the ruling of the judge and some rather harsh words that were spoken in her initial ruling, I think it was, we heard from a lot of legislators, we heard from the governor, we heard from many people that it was going to be even more important that the due diligence that we had already planned to do be expanded in order to carefully review to make sure that the team would not only be able to make good on their commitments today, but there was nothing at this point, either from a legal standpoint or a financial commitment standpoint, that could get in the way, you know, anytime soon that could arise. So the due diligence that was done was a very thorough investigation, and the report that's before you details exactly how that work was done and what it was that was looked at. But just in summary, what we were looking at was not only ensuring that we knew the financial capability was there and that the resources and assets that they had available to back the loans and whatever equity investments they would be making in the stadium were there. We also needed to know that there was no other litigation of a similar nature that could come into play that might affect their ability, you know, later on to move ahead. So it was kind of like once we had this information before us, we needed to make sure that there was nothing further that might come as a surprise. And
well, I can wait till she's done, Mr. Okay. Chairman. I'm sorry. Okay.
From our perception, I think it was important that we do this kind of deep dive into the information. So we took what we had planned to do anyway, which really was a very detailed financial audit that could corroborate what resources would be available. And added to it was this litigation piece where we looked at the New Jersey lawsuit in particular, because we knew we needed to move ahead before the judge's ruling would come out. So we weren't sure when the ruling was going to be made as to what kind of damages would have to be paid. So our attorneys did a deep investigation to try to determine sort of worst case scenario, what kind of damages potentially could be resulting, and then make sure that the resources that they had available could take care of not only that potential litigation and judgment, but also keep enough money and enough assets to back their current project. And, you know, as I think you had heard probably through news reports, and I know we sent this report to all the members of the committee as well, the due diligence turned up three pretty significant things. Number one, financially, even with the worst case scenario, and now that we have the judge's ruling, we know, in fact, that is the case, that the team definitely could make good on their commitments to the stadium, that there wouldn't be any financial issues with that, no matter what the ruling was, even looking at the various parameters. That was the first thing. The second thing that we uncovered was that basically there was no other, while there was certainly litigation that was out there, with which I think is fairly typical of a lot of different, you know, businesses and real estate companies. They're often tenants disputes and various disputes that take place. So while there is litigation out there, there was nothing that rose to the level that could be looked at in terms of the kind of resources that might be taken up in this one New Jersey suit that we're all aware of. So there was nothing else that rose. So that for us was important. We didn't want this due diligence to be done in 2 months or 6 months later, something else all of a sudden comes and people say, well, hello, why didn't you look beyond to see if there was anything else out there that was going to rise to that level? Clearly it didn't. So that was a very positive piece. And the only issue that we did raise, and we thought it was important to just sort of alert people to, was the fact that under New Jersey law, under the statute, when punitive damages are awarded in any case, no matter what, the court will refer the action to the county prosecutor and the attorney general for investigation as to whether a criminal act has been committed by the defendant. So the only thing we wanted to make sure, we have no reason to believe that there's going to be anything resulting from this, and, you know, it's unlikely that it would, but we, again, as part of our due diligence, just wanted to make sure that the public, elected officials, that everyone kind of as part of our due diligence was notified of this. That in turn led us to make sure that we got the assurance, and we got it in the form of a letter, and that was part of our report, a letter from the NFL just stating that in the course of the work that the NFL does and by policy and by practice, if there ever is any, you know, issues that arise of any sort, they assured us that they were committed to this project, that this is an NFL venue that they are not only interested in, but they are committed to in terms of their backing, both of the team and the state of Minnesota. So no matter what happens, they assured us that they would be a partner with us in moving ahead on the stadium. So with that, we felt like we really had covered our bases. Again, scenarios that are highly unlikely, but we just needed to make sure that the public could rest assured that we had looked at all the issues and that we had reached these agreements. The one thing I will say is, at the time, I started getting a lot of questions from people immediately saying this due diligence is going to be very expensive. How is this going to be paid for? And given the fact that additional due diligence is going to be required related to the lawsuit, how much public money is going to be used for this? So the authority had been very clear early on that we considered this to be sort of a two-phase process. The financial due diligence that would have had to have been done anyway, that we were planning to do, that the project expected to do as part of our directive in the legislation, would clearly be a project cost. And anything over and above that was required specifically related to, because resulting from the New Jersey court case, those costs would be borne by the team and or the family, the Will family. So the team at the time did not agree to that. I mean, they were very clear with us that we were saying it, but they weren't necessarily agreeing. But I will tell you, just in the last short time, as part of our agreements that we are structuring, they have agreed to pay that portion of the due diligence that's specifically related to the New Jersey lawsuit. So I know I had questions from a number of members along the way who had specifically asked me who was going to be paying those costs, and so I just wanted to let you know that that's the case. So that's an answer to the question and the request. That's the update on the due diligence. Are there any questions related to that or comments?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Three questions, all brief but probably uncomfortable. One was, and by the way, thank you for the efforts. I imagine you guys are probably working around the clock and have been for many months now. How much was paid for the due diligence, and how much is the Welfs or the team agreed to pay?
The due diligence, the total cost is $377,000. As you can well imagine, this was a very intensive effort by a lot of people in a very short amount of time. Of the 377,000, $158,000 is actually the amount that is related to the financial due diligence. And that's what we brought FTI, which does financial accounting. They came in and specifically did that financial work. And that was really the work that had to be done anyway. That was the work that we had planned to do. That was the due diligence that would verify their financial capabilities. $219,000 of it, which was the work that had to be done for the related to the New Jersey litigation and to do kind of the deep dive into the litigation to make sure there was no further outstanding issues that we had to worry about, the work that was done with the NFL to make sure that we could get their guarantees as a result of this litigation. That's the amount that the team will be reimbursing the authority for.
Representative Atkins, any follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Unrelated, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. As I understand what we're doing here today is that we are not able to ask you questions about what's in the actual agreements that are being executed between the authority and the team. Will you be taking action then before this entity, this oversight commission, gets an opportunity to see those contract terms?
Ms. Kim Helgen.
Yes, we will. I will tell you that literally, and we'll go through in a great amount of detail, but the work that's being done is all being done on the part of the authority as related to the legislation and within the framework of the legislation. Now, within that, there obviously are a lot of nuances and interpretations, if you will. But by and large, the legislation has been very specific about sources of revenue and what revenue is allowed and allocated, if you will, to the team and what revenue is allowed and allocated to the authority and how we are to proceed with our approach. So I will assure you that these agreements really reflect the legislation and put a lot of detail to the framework that was outlined. But if you do look at the legislation, it is very detailed as far as how these things are really to be focused and played out. And I will assure you that from my perspective, everything we did, I always went back to the legislation in order to interpret what the public interest might be and how to protect that interest. So,
Mr. Chair, then.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. And I don't know, Mr. Chair, this might be as much for you as for Chair Kim Helgen, but have you been meeting with the co-chairs? What makes me a little uncomfortable is, you know, we've been charged, I think that in the name of this is something like oversight or the Legislative Commission on Sports Facilities. My sense was that that was part of our role, was to be reviewing as things were moving ahead. And I'm not looking to slow things down any more than they've already been slowed down by the New Jersey lawsuit. But to sit here and not be have an opportunity to ask you about what's going into the agreements, and then you're going to act on the agreements before we get a chance to know what's in the agreements, you can kind of understand my being ill at ease. So my question, I guess, Madam Chair, have you been visiting with the chairs of this commission so that they have a sense of what's going to be in this agreement that's executed this afternoon or approved this afternoon?
Ms. Kim Helgen.
You know, I have had individual conversations with a number of members from the committee who have approached me with questions or concerns or ideas. So I have talked with people. I've met with a number of people individually, but I have not sat down with the full agreement and walked through it in any detail with anyone.
And Madam Chair, Chair.
Representative Atkins.
And Madam Chair, and I respect the desire to move forward with your process as rapid, and I also respect and have had a chance to work with you before, so I know that you're going to do your best to be true to the legislation. I leave it as something of an open question, Mr. Chair, to this body. I don't want to have one of those, you know, where I wake up in the morning and I read tomorrow again in the newspaper. what's in the agreement and have one of those oh my gosh moments on the, you know, the personal seat licenses has been an issue that's been in the news a lot, but there's any number, and I also don't want to micromanage what you're doing, but the idea of having the execution of the agreement take place before this body that's been charged with oversight even has a chance to know what's in the agreement seems like we've got the wagon and the cart and the horses and all of that good stuff. I've really messed up that metaphor,
Atkins,
haven't I, Mr. Chairman?
Oh, Representative Atkins, I'm sure you can appreciate that this Oversight Commission works with the authority, but the authority has the authority, for lack of a better word, to negotiate on behalf of the state. And in the event that Ms. Kim Helgen was to come before this body and articulate each aspect of the agreement, that means that she would be negotiating in public. And there are some things that, as you know, that people go back and forth about, and I'm not quite sure what you would have wanted to have happen, you know, short of us making sure that we come together, we get an update from the authority, and to be assured that the authority is constantly referring back to the legislation that has already been passed by this group on both sides of the aisle, right? And so I'm not sure if that's an open-ended question or if there's if it's rhetorical or if there's something else that you would like for us to.
I don't, Mr. Chairman, I don't think it was rhetorical at all. I think specifically what would I have liked to have seen? I would have liked to have seen these discussions over the past few months so we knew what direction the authority was moving. And then once the agreement was reached, that would be shared, tentative agreement, I should say, would be shared with this oversight body, just if we had any of those oh my moments where people were really uncomfortable and on whatever topic it might be, so that we could share that with the negotiators. They would then take that before the authority and they could execute the, because at this point now, as I understand it, and I might be wrong, but the authority is going to take action sometime later today.
5 o'clock is my understanding.
And after which we will have met. And again, I can't overstate that I don't want to micromanage every detail, but I just think we ought to have had a chance to see it or at least have those discussions taking place so that members know what's going to be part of that before we, you know, because at this point we don't even know when we're meeting again, and we haven't met since April. So I've just – all I'm getting at is, you know, I'm a little bit, you know, when – My concern over the past few months is that my own credibility and the credibility of the members of this commission has been somewhat in jeopardy because we haven't been meeting. We don't know what other than – and with great credit to Chair Kelm Helgen, we've gotten some updates. You know, we've gotten copies of the due diligence and things like that, and I greatly appreciate that. But at this point, with their acting on the proposed agreement, which we haven't seen yet, how do we perform oversight on that?
Well, Representative Atkins, I don't want to be the one to constantly go back and forth with you. I would refer you back to the legislation, and the legislation clearly articulates what this commission is to do and even our limitations as it pertains to that. And so your constant repeating of the same theme of this commission not meeting since April has been well said a number of times. We believe that between from April up to this particular time, she's clearly articulated that she's had several meetings with several different people, and that she was always ready, willing, and available for members to have a discussion with her as well. And with that being said, I don't want to turn this into a Senator Champion and Representative Atkins spar fight. So with that being said, if there are any other questions, I'll be happy to go to someone else.
Is it a spar fight or a bar fight? I couldn't.
Either.
Either one I'm not comfortable with,
okay.
Mr. Chairman. No, I think I've made my point, and I appreciate it, but it does make me uncomfortable to have the process moving forward without our opportunity to see it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. I do have a list here, and so I'm trying to make sure that I adhere to that. So, Representative Briner.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate, I think, the complexity of the situation we've gotten ourselves into in terms of the delayed timeline, but I do think it would behoove all of us to look carefully at the language of the legislation in terms of what our role as members of the commission is, as opposed to what the role of the authority is. So I would just encourage people to do that. The second question I have is really on a little bit different take, and that's Ms. Kelm-Helgen, I'd like to ask you regarding the governor's letter of September 16th. In your estimation, do you think the agreement that we will see unveiled at 5 o'clock takes into account the parameters that the governor recommended in that communication?
Chair Kelm-Helgen.
Yes. I mean, I really believe the one thing, and again, as I say there, that is, I've been really clear as people have asked me. I think that's probably been the most asked question by the press and the public is what's going to happen with the seat licenses. And, you know, that probably has been, I'd say, one of the top three most difficult issues to reach agreement on, both from the team's perspective as well as from the authority's perspective. I did hear from a lot of people, a good number of legislators expressed concerns about the seat licenses and the framework and the numbers and, you know, just saying, I know they're probably going to be used, but, you know, it's really got to be a Minnesota solution. And obviously this was a very significant item to the governor and something that he felt very strongly about. I really think all those communications that I had were very helpful because it did help me to understand kind of the levels of concern and try to hopefully negotiate on the part of the public a program and a framework that's going to substantially, you know, satisfy at least some of the objections. I know just having a program in and of itself is going to make, you know, a lot of people angry. But as long as there is one, I think it's got to be very Minnesota-focused. I think it will look very different than some of the recent programs that you've seen in other states. That is kind of the final piece that we all have been negotiating and kind of set aside to the very end, sort of like, okay, assuming all these other pieces come together, then we'll have final agreement on this piece. So we actually, I mean, that is the one piece when I go back this afternoon that we're going to wrap up, and it's been something I've been intimately involved in, and I'm really trying hard to make sure that all the interests are balanced. And I think that we might get there to a certain extent, but as I say, you know, I'm sure there'll be a lot of people just having anything is not going to be a good thing. So, but we'll lay it out, and, you know, the one thing I'm really clear about this afternoon is in this meeting, we're going to just have everything out there, the summary. I'm going to walk through all the controversial issues that I've been hearing from people about, point out to the press and the public where this all sits in these agreements and what the solutions were and kind of how we got there. And I think it's really hard because you look at something like SBLs and you kind of pull it out in isolation and people, you know, can have opinions about it. But you really need to look at it in the context of the entire agreement and sort of, you know, what the intention was by the legislature for how the authority would get revenue and sort of our steady stream and then some of the more uncertain revenue sources that the team is really allowed to have but are much more uncertain but have probably much more upside. So that was kind of the balance we did, and I'm going to walk through very specifically tonight and sort of outline, you know, how it all came together and how it all fits as a total, because I think that's an important view to take.
A follow-up, Representative Bryan?
Thank you.
Senator Sharon?
You may have started to answer my questions, but what would be helpful to me, even though you can't expose the details of your negotiations, would you highlight for me what the subject matters are in the negotiations around the use agreement, the lease agreement, the development agreement, and the financial agreements? What are the critical points of discussion, even though you may not be able to reveal the decisions made around them, would you highlight what the debate is around in each of those areas.
Well, I don't think anyone in this room would share anything.
Yeah.
I thought that'd be fun.
Chair Kim Hilgen.
You know, I was thinking about this because I anticipate that question will come tonight as well. You know, you've been negotiating all these things. What have you been negotiating about? It seems like everything sort of boils down to sort of maybe three big buckets, if you will. Clearly, revenue in terms of what revenue streams and how is it divided and allowed for the team and what is there for the authority. And I mean, again, this is where I think the legislation was really helpful, because the legislation, if you look at how it was designed, was very specific. Under this new agreement versus where we had been in the old Metrodome. In the old Metrodome, we get revenue from the ticket sales of the team. We get revenue from the concessions of the team. You know, we get revenue from all these different sources. What the new legislation, really the framework that they really put together was, and I'm not saying anything we're going to, you know, talk more specifically, but this was all outlined in the legislation. It's very specific that says, okay, the authority needs to have, the state needs to have a guaranteed revenue source, and we want the team to pay a very specific amount for rent. So essentially what we have is we've got right around, and I'm just doing this off the top of my head, so don't quote me, but it's right around $10 million a year that is paid as rent payments essentially, and I think it's like 8.5 in rent and 1.5 in capital. And that's an annual, that $10 million, and again, remember, they play 10 games in the stadium per year. And those 10 games produce $10 million a year in revenue, so basically $1 million per game. It's a guaranteed source of revenue. We know we're going to have it. And to be honest, it covers close to 70% of our operating costs for the year. So that for us was kind of the position that the state decided that we needed to have the guaranteed revenue source. And then the revenue source on the other side for the team is essentially things like naming rights, advertising, as well as ticket revenue for their games and concession revenue for their games. So it was just, I mean, that was all defined in the statute. So what I'll do when we go through all this, and of course there's many nuances, because while the team gets advertising revenue, there actually in the agreements are some carve-outs for the authority to get some advertising revenue from, you know, our events and that kind of thing. So those are the kind of divisions that are laid out and outlined in the agreements. And those are the kind of things we spend a lot of time on, because while those general pieces are there, as you can well imagine, how that really plays out and, you know, what is the signage plan? And if they have advertising rights, where do those signs go? And I mean, you know, it's just so many details. So that kind of the revenue split is very important. And it's important for the authority to know that we've got good, solid, guaranteed sources of revenue that we're never going to have to come back to the state and say, hat in hand, we can't operate our building. So that was number one. Number two, as you can well imagine, there's a lot of things that play out when you've got public financing and private financing, and how all those pieces come together and just sort of the framework of how their funding comes in and financing comes in as well as ours. So there was a lot of discussion around that. Just in general, there was a lot of negotiation that went on in terms of liability and risk. Obviously, from the authority standpoint, we needed to make sure that we protected the state and the public as much as possible from liability and risk. And while we are the developer, We are the owner and operator of the stadium. We obviously are capped in terms of the amount of money we have, and we don't have essentially revenue-raising authority. We can't tax. We aren't like the Met Council. We don't have any way to raise any further money other than our revenue sources that we were able to, you know, insure. Some of it was insured in the legislation, and some of it was negotiated. So, but beyond that, because we don't have a source of revenue raising, we had to make sure that we also limited our liability. So we don't want to put ourselves in a position where, you know, the team or their lender could come back and, you know, sue us for something. So there was a lot of that that we were concerned about. So there's many different things, but just I would, in the interest of time, those are probably the major categories that we worked on.
Senator Sharon, any follow-up?
Yes. When you're talking about the NFL having a commitment to the project in the long term, are they're talking about the resources to build the facility, but not in relationship to this other commitment of money for the operations of the facility?
Chair Kim Helgen.
Well, and again, the NFL makes financial commitments from a building standpoint to the team in terms of their financing. And that is definitely, you know, I think it's been reported publicly that the NFL has agreed to $150 million in a loan that will go to the team as part of their financing and $50 million in a grant. But the NFL, as I understand it, does not put money in from an operating standpoint, but that would probably be a better question for Steve Popham when he comes, because I feel a little out of my league, so to speak.
No, that's fine. When you're saying that the NFL is making a commitment, then what you're really saying is that they'll continue to make a commitment to their $150 million, their portion of the payment to the team.
Well, what I was referring to related to the due diligence is the NFL was very clear that, and this is true, let's just say something happened, you know, to any owner of any franchise. You know, here we are in the middle of building this building, and something happens, and somehow the team couldn't make good on their commitment. The NFL basically said, we are committed to this market. We are committed to this building. We want an NFL team there. And if something were to happen, we would make sure that there was, you know, maybe a new owner of the Vikings or something like that. That's what I was referring to. I'm not referring to any ongoing operating commitment, but they're clearly committed to this market, and they were absolutely committed to the Will family and the Vikings and very supportive all the way through as we did our due diligence work.
Senator Sharon,
I won't take all the time, but I'll just ask one more. I have several questions, but others probably will answer them as much as I will. When you're talking about these various revenue streams that are clearly defined, in your negotiations, though, you can adverse certain pressure points in agreement processes, engage in conversations about limiting the size of those revenue streams. Cost of tickets or how tickets are sold or the cost of seats, has that been a part of what it is that you're engaged in negotiating on behalf of the people of the state?
Mm-hmm.
Chair Kim Helgen.
I mean, we certainly had a lot of discussion surrounding the cost of the seat licenses and what a framework would be that we potentially would agree to. So we certainly did that. The legislation calls for a certain number of affordable seats to be available, and we spent a lot of time looking at, you know, sort of a definition of affordable tickets and how many of those tickets would be available and how they would be available. The team, while the legislation clearly gives them the right to set their ticket price, and again, I mean, the legislation is quite detailed in a lot of areas, and it clearly gives them rights over the ticket sales per se and the pricing. But we had a lot of conversations about that, and they did talk about what their pricing would be. And again, I don't want to speak for them, and it's not outlined in these agreements per se. But I definitely got a lot of comfort that they're not looking at, you know, sort of their pricing structure that they have today. While clearly in a new facility, it'll be updated somewhat, it's not greatly different. So, again, I don't want to speak for them, and that is their...
I'm sorry. Let me be a little clearer. As you're talking about that, you're describing all of the decision and the power and the decision-making is in, as it is, for the revenue stream to be in ticketing your seating prices. But there are negotiations occurring now and in which you could ask for. They can negotiate with you, and you can establish in those negotiations parameters that they would operate within well into the future on behalf of the citizens of the state who are making a significant contribution to this facility. My question is whether or not you are using those pressure points that you have to engage in those kinds of conversations and restrictions, reasonable ones.
Chair Kim Hogan.
We did have all those conversations. They definitely know our opinions, and I felt comfortable in what they were telling us, that specifically as related to ticket price, that the prices that they're going to be charging, I think, are in line with what they have been charging and reasonable as far as kind of market rates, if you will. I will say we did not put limitations on within the agreements, and again, I will just say that, you know, we definitely have limitations in a framework as it relates to the seat licenses, because the legislation was very specific that that's something that we control and is in our purview. So while the revenue is in the team's column, we certainly, by legislation, have control of that. The legislation is very specific that the team controls their tickets and their pricing. I mean, it actually says that in the legislation. So there's no, when you see the agreements, there's nothing that has been negotiated per se that talk about limitations on ticket prices or anything else. So I'll just leave it at that. But
and I have this to order just so the commission members will know, Representative Dabney, Representative Hoppe, and then Senator Miller.
Representative Dabney. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Kelman-Helgen, looking over the due diligence documents that you were good enough to forward to commission members, I see that and I'm reminded that the legislation requires that funds be committed up front. As I understand it, I'm looking at your press release. All private sources for the construction of the new stadium be committed funds that are adequate to design and construct the stadium. Mm-hmm. What is the structure of that commitment going to be?
Chair Kim Hogan.
Well, the team will close on their financing November 1st. And as part of that, and again, I would, you know, I think that the team can speak to this, but this whole financing structure and commitment, I will say, is part of what was negotiated as part of this agreement. And it probably is the most complicated piece of what we're doing. But I can tell you in general, nothing too mysterious. It's, I think, what you might be asking, because I get this question a lot. So you've got you look at the team's $477 million, and it's made up of, you know, really three pieces, if you will. One is the NFL commitment, which, as I mentioned, I think everyone knows, is $200 million. Then there will be a piece that is made up from seat licenses. I mean, I think it's no mystery. It said we were allowed, that the team was allowed to use that, but it would be the decision of the authority. I don't think I'm revealing anything too major to say there is going to be a seat license component. So that is a piece of it. And then there will be another component that's made up of the teams, the families, equity and or loan that comes into the project. And so those are the combinations, if you will.
Representative Dabney, follow up?
I guess, Mr. Chair, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to better understand, and I'm in the deep end of the pool, to use the wrong sports analogy. What's the legal structure, maybe particularly then for the team equity portion. What assurance do Minnesotans have that that money will be there, that it will be up front, and that it will be secure?
Chair Kim Helgen.
Okay. I really am going to have to defer this because, first of all, I'm not, that's probably not my area of greatest expertise. I think I know the answer to that question, but I'm not 100% sure. And I'm not sure right now, given where we're at. I mean, those things will all be outlined in those agreements. So I really, you know, at this point, and I really am a little bit uncomfortable because sort of my hallmark always is to answer questions openly and honestly. I do think everyone knew when coming into this there's going to be a little bit of a challenge because, you know, obviously these agreements are not finalized. Everything, and when I say things change, I mean it's nothing is finalized at this point, and it really isn't until we talk about it at our board table tonight that I would feel comfortable, you know, having that discussion with you. So I apologize. It will be in the agreements, and you'll be able to look at it more specifically. But in addition, I will say, just talking about the actual financial structure, it's a little bit out of my league anyway to try to do that from memory here at the table.
One last question.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you. And Chair Kelmhagen, I appreciate very much the value you put on transparency. The public obviously has a great interest in this, and you're right, not everybody's going to be happy no matter what the agreements are, but they deserve to have full access to the documents, to the agreements in a timely fashion, and to understand those. So I appreciate that. Last question, looking at the letter from Commissioner Goodell, I appreciate the commitment that the NFL is stating in that letter, but I'm not clear that it reaches a point of something that's legally enforceable. That if there's a change in ownership, will there be stipulations? Does any of the agreement reflect a legally enforceable negotiated agreement that the Vikings will be staying out through this lease if there's a change in ownership?
Yes, yes. And our agreements, I mean, you will see that. I can assure you, you will see that very much. I mean, that's one of the pieces of our agreement as well. I mean, not only, because there could be, for many reasons, there could be a change in ownership. It happens, you know, with sports teams along the way periodically. And what happens then and what the commitment is all outlined in the use agreement that we will be signing with the team.
Thank you, Ms. Kelmhagen. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two comments, and I'm not to beat a dead horse. I'm going to go back to Representative Atkins' earlier comments, and I appreciate him making the point. We didn't meet for a long time, and I'm not suggesting that some members of the committee, a small number, were meeting with the commission or with the team. But there were comments made that lead me to bring this up again. I think going forward, and Representative Atkins and I are going to have to leave before we get to number six, the scheduling, I do think it's incumbent upon this committee to make sure we are meeting more frequently, more regularly, and that we're not creating a de facto committee within the committee that's meeting with the commission. I think that would be bad for both the House and the Senate. And I'm, again, not suggesting that anything untoward happen. I just think that we would be wise to not let anything like that happen. My second comment is, and I'm not going to be here for Mr. Barrett's testimony either, but I think when we start talking about fundraising for the stadium, one of the things we should strongly consider is looking again at legislation with how we're treating the charitable gaming in the state. We're not raising anywhere close to the money we were hoping to raise from the e-poll tabs, and there's a very simple way to do that. We just change the tax structure, and I don't know what the number would be, but instead of grossing 1%, if we could change it to 2.5% or 3% if they use on monies generated from e-poll tabs and let those charities keep more of the money for the Lions or the Legion or the Little League in different places around the state, if they're keeping more of that money to spend in their communities on the charitable, whatever charitable projects they have, it's going to help those communities. It's also going to contribute greatly to the bottom line and our funding problem, which is something I hope we consider at another upcoming hearing. The state's portion of that will again go back to being funded by people that are voluntarily doing charitable gaming, and then we'll all be happier. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to apologize to the members of the committee, but Representative Atkins and I have to sneak out a little early to a previous commitment.
So, thank you for your comments. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree we need to meet more often, and I think that message has been loud and clear, and I think that we will meet more often. My question to you, Madam Chair, is can you just give us a timeline? I understand there's a meeting tonight, 5 o'clock. What does that meeting entail? When will these actual agreements be signed? And then what happens from there? What's the next 6 months look like, and then maybe the next year?
Chair sure. Kim Helgen.
Yes, the meeting is tonight at 5 o'clock, and I will tell you, just kind of based on where we were at this morning, these documents may be posted as almost draft documents, if you will. Like, in substance, they're done, but I think everyone's a little concerned that, given the fact that we're literally kind of still negotiating some of these points, we may need a night to read them before we do a final signing. So when I left, we hadn't really reached agreement on with the team and everyone as to how we were going to do this. But one of the things that we talked about was we're going to post the documents on the website, so they'll be public information. Everybody can take a look at them tonight. We will have our meeting, and our board will vote on them, and essentially, assuming they can approve them, that they agree with them, that they will then authorize us to sign the documents maybe tomorrow morning. So I don't know that they'll physically be signed tonight. They might be signed in the morning. I'm not sure. But they will be signed here in, you know, by tomorrow. Then the next kind of big step that we're coming up to is we are in the process. Mortenson, who's our construction firm, is doing the. Will be coming up with a guaranteed maximum price. We essentially have decided we're doing a construction manager at risk process, and Mortenson will be giving us a guaranteed maximum price. And that for the state is really important because that will cap our risk, and will, you know, engage them as our partner. So that guaranteed maximum price will happen in October, and that's what will set the final number and will set the final budget for the project, et cetera. And then the team financing should close November 1st. And assuming they can make that date of November 1st, then the state financing should close mid-November. And our groundbreaking will take place around mid-November as well. And then we will, as you know, the team will finish their season sometime in January, hopefully after a playoff game or two.
Or maybe February.
Or maybe February.
February.
Assuming their playoff games are the end of January, so then they would finish in February. And we would have the building be taken down beginning then in February. As you can imagine, there'll be at least 4 to 6 weeks of kind of disassembly once the season is over. Pieces will come out, as I understand it from Mortenson, but again, I'm a little over my skis on this, but I have heard Mortenson say that they're not going to implode the building. They'll take it down in a traditional demolition fashion in segments. And so by winter, the building will be gone, and they will be beginning construction. So Mortenson actually, to get ready to set that guaranteed maximum price, has been bidding a lot of the project already, getting bids from subcontractors so they get their pricing in place. We've got a lot of information already on the building and kind of how things are moving along. Prices, I will say, are coming in a little bit higher than what we had expected. I think with the construction boom picking up, there's, you know, a little bit of price sensitivity there. So We've been moving along and keeping our building in budget, however, so whatever it takes, that's what we're doing.
Senator Miller, follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only follow-up I would have is after Mortenson comes out with that guarantee maximum price, if, and this maybe this is a question for the Vikings, if they want to do any additions or go anything above and beyond that guaranteed maximum price, then that would be the responsibility of the Vikings and not the Sports Authority.
Yes, our budget is capped at $975, and that is true. There are some alternatives, some additional pieces that they are looking at that they might consider. So we'll have more to come on that as well.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kelm-Helligan, since this is also known as the People's Stadium, will the agreements you sign in the next couple of days contain language allowing the high school football playoffs, for example, college and high school baseball, to be played there at a reasonable cost?
Sure. Absolutely. Thank you for that. Yes. You know, that again, as Senator Sharon asked the question about where a lot of our focus and negotiation has gone, we are very clear, and your legislation was very clear, that events that had been taking place in the Metrodome must be accommodated as much as possible in the new stadium. You know, one of the big negotiating items early on, and our architects really helped us with that, was to accommodate baseball. And the team, that was kind of your classic. The team had to give on some of the seats being retractable so that we could accommodate that right field line so that we would have the, and you know, you get a little, there are trade-offs there when you have retractable seats, and it affects the whole design of that half of the stadium. But they were willing to do it, and our architect had some great solutions, and I think everybody's really happy with that. But we play over 500 baseball games for high school, colleges, and it's minuscule schools, it's two-year colleges. I mean, it's spring baseball. We are the home field for all those higher ed institutions, and we definitely will accommodate that, as well as state high school soccer, girls and boy championships, regionals, same thing for football, youth football in the summer. All of that we're going to accommodate. That is definitely a big part of what we are committed to. Even the rollerbladers, who we heard from in force. So in the winter, they can have corridors that are 360 degrees. That's going to be accommodated. So we took that charge in the legislation from you very seriously, and we will accommodate all of those events. That's what this is all about.
Representative Anderson, any follow-up? Any other questions? Senator Sharon.
A follow-up on that, it sort of draws me back to the earlier discussion that you mentioned. I can't remember if it's part of the lease agreement or where it came in, comes into your negotiations, but it's the $10 million that you're receiving from the team that accounts for approximately 70% of the operating in that range.
Roughly. I mean, we aren't quite sure what our operating costs are going to be in this new building. But
that's what I was going to ask, if you were pretty sure about that. But that that particular component is for how long? How long is that payment being made?
30 years with an inflation, 3% inflation. So the term of the lease is 30 years, and that, again, was in legislation. And then there's some five-year extensions that they can have as well. But
I guess what I'm trying to get at is this money that you're talking about that I think the public needs to understand, besides the dollars that the Vikings are putting into the actual physical structure development, there is an ongoing resource coming from the Vikings to help the operating expenses of this facility for more than the time that they're using it, so that teams like Representative Anderson was talking about can use the facility, afford to use the facility, because they won't be carrying as much of the operating expenditures as a result of the Vikings' participation at this level. I'm just wondering if that is a 30-year, is that those 30 dollars
you're
talking about?
30-year commitment for
over
rent from,
years?
Yes. Cheer. With a 3% inflator, and that, again, is part of the agreement.
Just to make sure that I'm getting, may I?
Senator Sheeran.
That the, because I think it's important that we're talking not only about the amount of money that's being contributed here to the building of the building, but also the ongoing revenue stream that helps support these other teams that that Representative Anderson is talking about. There's a value in that, and we don't hear about that very much in the public.
Yeah.
Any comments on that, Chair?
No, I mean, the only thing I do when I go out and I do a lot of speaking, not only in the metro area, but even in greater Minnesota, I'm asked to come to rotaries and chambers and all sorts of public meetings. And a lot of times when I talk about this and people will say, oh, why are we subsidizing that team? And I always say, well, you know, if you think about it, I would just want to point out they play 10 games and they give us, for those 10 games, $10 million that pay a significant portion of our operating costs that allows us to let a baseball team come in and pay $500. I mean, you can't even turn on the lights for 10 minutes in the Metrodome for $500. I mean, it is so subsidized in terms of those kind of events. Now, there's other events, you know, our dirt events, and if we, you know, eventually now, hopefully we can do concerts, and you'll have, we'll have some other money-making opportunities. That rent obviously goes to the authority. But all those kind of events will subsidize these community, nonprofit events that are held there all year long. And imagine how cool it's going to be for the state high school football championships and all these baseball teams who can come into this beautiful new facility and play their games for very, very reasonable costs. If you talk to the Minnesota State High School League, I mean, they are our biggest supporters because those schools all over the state rely on this all spring long, or they could never schedule all these, you know, all their events. A year like this, where we had all this bad weather into June, we were playing almost round the clock through June. I mean, it's amazing. That will continue.
Any other questions before we go on to our next presenter? If nothing else, Chair, thank you so very much for coming, and we so appreciate it. And we will be having another meeting in a month, so I'm sure that we'll get a chance to hear the specifics of the agreement. I am now going to ask, on the agenda you see Lester Bagley from the Minnesota Vikings, but in his stead is going to be Steve Poppin. If you could come up and give us an update, that'd be great. This is another person who's been in fierce negotiations for the last, you know, 36 to 40 hours. I also would like to remind the commission, if you look at the letter of the legislation, this body has control, for lack of a better word, or oversight, I should use, of the authority, not of the sports team. But so I want to make sure that that's clear. Because sometimes, you know, we like to assert ourselves, but I just want us to be clear of that. All right? And welcome to the committee, and if you'll introduce yourself, and please feel free to go forward.
Mr. Chair, Steve Poppin with the Minnesota Vikings. I appreciate the opportunity to be here in front of this committee. We are, as Chair Kelm Helgen just mentioned, we're in the midst right now of trying to wrap up two very critical documents in the use agreement, which is the operating governance document for the next 30 years, as well as the development agreement that will manage and govern the actual construction of the facility. Once we wrap up these two agreements, it's a very significant milestone in the project. These documents will reflect what was negotiated with the city and the team, as well as the state of Minnesota, in the legislation that you guys passed in May of 2012. We believe that these agreements are fair and follow the line of the legislation, both for the public and the team as well. And finalizing these documents will help ensure getting this project going and on time, keeping it on time, keeping it on budget, as well as putting thousands of Minnesotans back to work. We're very excited about this. As Chair Kelm Helgen mentioned, we're trying to wrap some stuff up, and we've been going for many weeks, and especially the last month here, virtually around the clock. So we are excited to wrap it up and show you what's been done. So I know Lester had some special announcement that he was supposed to make. He failed to tell me what that was. So I just wanted to he's out of town today, so I'm here. Apologize for that. But if you have any questions for me, I'm available.
I think that's a wonderful segue. Lester is still out of town, and his plane does not land until 3:45. And I did everything within my power to tell him to come back earlier and to make that plane land earlier, but I was unsuccessful, needless to say. But we are pleased to have you. So any questions for Mr. Poppin that he might be able to answer? Representative Briner.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Poppin, could you give me your view of the November 1st deadline in terms of the team's financial commitment being in place by that date?
Mr. Poppin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a tight deadline, and we have a lot of work to do in the next three to 4 weeks. We believe we can get there, and we're excited to get there, to get the project going, and getting these documents done and signed off and approved today is critical in getting that done, because the NFL owners are meeting on Tuesday in Washington, D.C., and with the approval of the authority, then the use agreement would be approved by the league as well.
A follow-up? Any other questions for Mr. Poppin? If none, Senator Sharon.
I'm drawing a conclusion that might be wrong. It will be reviewed next Tuesday and approved, the use agreement approved by the NFL, did you say?
Mr. Poppin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, yes, that is correct.
And if they don't approve?
We have every right to reason to believe that they will, based on they've been in the process all along. So we feel very confident that it's going to take place.
Any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Poppin, there was talk about a professional soccer team, also a talk of the Vikings, if they so choose to finance a retractable roof. Any further discussion in those two areas?
Mr. Poppin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, with respect to Major League Soccer, yes, that was part of the legislation that that we negotiated as part of the term sheet. We're very interested in Major League Soccer. We've had a number of conversations with Major League Soccer. We're a little focused on trying to get this stadium off the ground, but we are very interested in that. The Wilf family has an interest in soccer. And we are looking, and we believe that the Minneapolis market is a robust market for Major League Soccer. We are looking at it, and we're really looking forward to pursuing that.
A follow-up, Representative Anderson?
You didn't mention a retractable roof.
Yes.
Mr. Poppy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, with respect to the retractable roof, there will be a retractable feature on the facility. It's not going to be a retractable roof. When we went through the design, and Chair Ken Helgen can speak to this as well, we, you know, $975 seems like a lot of money. You can build a lot of building, and you can, but you can't have everything you want. And when we were going through the process and trying to figure out what that meant to the building is from a cost standpoint, and what it was taking away from an experience standpoint, both for the community and for the team, the decision was made that the retractable roof itself was not just, we just didn't have it in the budget. I think the amazing part of the design team that we have is we have this technology called ETFE, which was part of the design rollout in May, which is a material that is translucent. So you'll be able to be in an enclosed facility and be able to see outside and at least have that experience. So,
any other questions? Senator Sharon.
You may not be able to answer this. I may have to ask Michelle again, Chair. But as you're talking about this question of the possible use of another professional team in this stadium, in the discussions that you're having about negotiating use agreement, are there provisions being negotiated about that? that changed the frequency with which other teams would have access to the facility and changed the obligations of the team in terms of that amount of money that they pay for the operating expenditures.
Mr. Poppe.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, yes. With respect to Major League Soccer, the legislation that was passed, we had negotiated essentially the terms of how the revenue split would be for Major League Soccer at that point in time. With respect to the use agreement, one of the things that when we make this decision to do this, part of that is the authority will negotiate a rent payment with us. That's something that has to be negotiated at that point in time.
Senator Shannon, any follow-up?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Poppin? Seeing none, thank you so very much.
I do.
Oh, she does.
Does it take remember. Does it take priority then? Do you have a priority utilization for this soccer team over other uses besides the regular Viking season?
Mr. Poppin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, with respect to soccer, it won't have the same priority as the Minnesota Vikings. It will be considered a major tenant in the facility. With respect to taking away from the community events, I don't see that happening. I mean, and the authority will make sure that the other community events that are scheduled in that building will continue to be scheduled in that building, and we will work around those.
Again, any more questions, Senator Shannon?
You never know.
No, I appreciate you. Thank you, Mr. Poppin, for coming over, and I know you have to get back to negotiations. And I also want to thank Larry Redmond for his help in getting us someone here. Thank you so very much. With that being said, while I would like to call up Tom Barrett from the Gambling Control Board, and while he's making his way to the podium, I will want to remind the committee that in your packets you will have the request for reimbursement, and if you complete that and turn that in, we'll make sure that it is honored. If nothing else, Mr. Barrett, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. By way of introduction, my name is Tom Barrett. I'm the director of the Gambling Control Board and appreciate the opportunity to come before this group and give a brief update. If it was all right with you, I thought I'd do a very brief kind of overview, highlight some of the issues, concerns, as well as talk of where things might be heading. As you all know, electronic gaming has not produced the numbers as originally projected, at least not on the global scale that we were all anticipating. But I think as you look back legislatively, last session, you recognize that fact. The governor recognized that fact and actually proposed alternatives to help in that respect as far as the funding for the bonding. And while much has been written about the lack of activity with the charitable gaming, I do want to take the opportunity to talk about some of the positives as well as alert the committee of what's down the road as relates to electronic gaming and the like. But first and foremost, electronic gaming in Minnesota is very well alive. I know we've read a lot of in the newspapers, but it continues to be the largest in the country in terms of gaming activity, with just over $1.1 billion in gaming receipts provided as an overview of the most recent fiscal year that closed. But that represents approximately an 8% increase. Significant in the sense if you're a local veterans post or fire relief organizations to see those numbers on the rebound a bit from where they were going back to the heyday of $1.4 billion in 2005. So in that respect, in terms of activity, we obviously are watching an increase in that respect. But as it relates to electronics, this is something the charitable gaming industry approached the legislature a few years ago. And it was recently with the advent and opportunity with the stadium funding to give serious consideration. And they were given an opportunity in that format to supplement the paper games, the bingo games, the raffle. And while it was a fairly new concept 2 years ago, the way things we're seeing now in terms of gaming format and the technology, it is virtually set to explode, maybe not necessarily in Minnesota. But we see big vendors. This is the Bally's, the IGT, Aristocrats, even our own lottery contract vendors, GTEC, Scientific Games. All those vendors are getting into the mobile market technology. We just got word last week, our biggest paper pull tab vendor, Arrow International, is getting in to the electronic gaming market. And the message here is things are changing as it relates to that gaming format, whether it's under charitable, tribal, lottery. It's one of those things that we're not using the paper much anymore. But at the same time, paper, as you can see in the activity for the last fiscal year, is very robust as relates to the Minnesota activity. If you had a chance to go out to the G Concourse at our airport, you would have gone through and saw maybe some of the restaurants that literally have an iPad-type device on every table. And while those don't all play the electronic games, it's the point is the technology is literally being put in front of people at different venues. To the extent that the lottery might offer their games, that's one of the more recent revelations in terms of our own counterparts in the gaming industry in Minnesota, where they've launched the iLottery games, where you can buy your Powerball ticket at home now, have an account set up. We expect to see electronic scratch tickets on devices in the near future. And I think it's a message not just to the commission but to the public in terms of where gaming could be heading, not just maybe in Minnesota but in other jurisdictions, all having some impact on the industry that we regulate. While technology is rapidly changing, I think our biggest effort as gaming regulators is to try to stay abreast of these changes and what's happening. We see a lot of vendors very creative games offering, but at the same time, given some of the restrictions and limitations in the Minnesota law as relates to electronic pull tabs, you can't have a spinning reel. You can't have it mimic a slot machine. And so our task is, what does that mean? What does it mimic a slot machine? But I will give credit to the vendors that are on board in the games that they've produced to have a little creative flair for the pull tab games. And it's got some of the interest with the players. But I think in terms of giving credit back to you all and working with the industry, the legislation that was passed as relates to the devices, as relates to the technical standards, were paramount to what we knew at the time. And by that I mean other states are looking to what was crafted here just strictly as the technology aspect. And it's a credit to what was proposed, how we move forward working with the industry to get these devices. Now, while all that's very well and done, the reality is, Tom, what happened? And there's a number of things that happened, but I do want to leave with maybe some samples in terms of, we got the, and I can certainly answer any questions about the annual report, but if you were to flip the page in the second, we're starting into the next fiscal year, and the far column already gives an indication that, once again, the industry, the sales are running ahead of activity from the previous year. Those are good signs as relates to the gaming industry. One of the things you don't see or hear really much at all are those locations that are doing very well with electronic gaming. I know earlier you looked ahead at some of the handouts and saw the picture of Porky's Bar. And the message, it's a visual, but I think you all received a picture. And I don't mean to make light of Porky's Bar. It's a great reputable bar on the east side of St. Paul on Payne Avenue. But it's the number one location in terms of electronic gaming activity. So I left the picture showing that this is not a facility that's got searchlights or neon lights. In fact, it's got two outdated beer signs. But the fact that it had 95,000 in electronic sales in the month of August, which normally is a slow month for activity, and as you can see by the graph comparing before electronics, after electronics, a very visual in terms of this particular site, this particular charity, taking the opportunity with electronic gaming and making it work. Now, granted, the list of successful sites are far fewer than what we were expecting. The other graph behind that, another very small local bar, if you've had the pleasure to be up in Eveleth, Minnesota, but the Roosevelt Bar. Again, an indication showing prior to electronics coming in, and seeing what it's done in that case for that particular charity, in this case, Climb Theater. It works. And when we went back to some of these sites and these charities that were having success, the simple question is, why does it work for you? And the response was, Tom, it's not really a secret. It's the bar owner working cooperatively with the charity, who in turn works with the vendors. And so that's good to hear, to the extent that the other locations take note of some of the success. We've had the pleasure to work closely with representatives from the LA Charities, representing charity groups, Minnesota Licensed Beverage, representing the bar owners, to try to do what we can as regulators to make these games as available if they want to go that route. But I think we still see the wait-and-see approach in many instances. Maybe they'd still like to see more vendors. We're still working with vendors, and that's another positive sign. We've had two additional manufacturers' applications now pending. They're going through the background checks. Inquiries from other vendors, what's going on in Minnesota, and that tells us there's opportunity, that this is not a total flop or some of the other things you've read. It's just whether or not this industry wants to respond to the opportunity given them. And that's where I focus the attention on the charities. So while I didn't mean to make light of pictures, but I thought it's truly a visual. If a corner bar such as Porky's or Roosevelt, Neveleth, and others can certainly see this kind of an increase, it certainly could become a model for others. So with that brief overview, I'd certainly stand for any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Barrett? Any questions? Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barrett, how many vendors currently do we have in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Barrett.
Electronic bowl tabs.
Yep. Mr. Chair and Senator, just to clarify that as in terms of the vendors and maybe as opposed to the sites, because I know that's another
correct
possible
vendors
question, but we have three primary vendors right now that are providing electronic pull tab type games, and then we have two vendors. I didn't really talk much of electronic link bingo. That's another electronic game element, and there's currently two licensed vendors providing that game format.
Senator Miller.
Mr. Barrett, where are we at with the electronic bingo?
Mr. Barrett.
I mean, what's the rollout on that?
Yep, Mr. Chair and Senator. Electronic bingo has begun. We have one vendor that's actively trying to sign up sites. We have another vendor that's live, but they're still in their beta test where they want to educate the players, the sites that are doing that. But all told, there's, I believe it's about 170 sites that have the capability to play linked bingo. But they're trying to get I think the number I've heard is about 300 sites on board, trained, ready to go, and then they begin a little more advanced marketing sales to say, here's what that activity is producing. At the same time, we have other vendors reworking bingo, looking at different game formats.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barrett, one of the concerns that I'm hearing from local charities or local establishments are the startup costs. Can you talk a little bit about those startup costs, if any, or how that works, or how an establishment or charity would get signed up for electronic pull tabs and or electronic bingo?
Mr. Barrett.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I appreciate that opportunity because that's one of a little bit of the misinformation that's been out there. By way of background, when legislation was first considered, legislators said, well, geez, this cost shouldn't all be borne by the charity that's licensed. The bar's got a stake in terms of opportunity to bring customers in. And so there was an allocation or an expense allocated to the bar owners as far as it relates to the Internet and that communication network. So in law, they're required to pay that relative expense. Now, we have some vendors that'll set up a dedicated line for their design of the system, and then there's others that'll do it on a shared internet. So if you got your ATM machine and the like. So there, I want to point out there's a difference. But what was written up recently was the, I think I wrote it down, incredibly expensive expense, cost, upfront cost. And I read that and I thought, wow, that I might be missing something, and it's really not, because with the bar owner is required to pay is anywhere from $150 to, I think, just over $900 up front to get the internet line established and the like. The expectation is they're going to get their money back with increased rent, increased activity. So the upfront cost of the bar owner ranges from approximately $150 to $900. The upfront cost of the charities, where they're responsible for the equipment, is zero. None of the agreements in place today show any upfront cost to the charity. It's all based on a percentage of what they sell. So if they place the equipment in these sites and they're not playing the game, they don't make any money. Nobody makes any money. So in terms of that point, because that came out and I'm not sure who where the message got mixed, but as far as upfront costs, working with the industry kept it very minimal as best we could.
Any other follow-up questions with Mr. Barrett? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. Mr. Barrett, in your spreadsheet, the yearly total for the e-pull tabs was about $15 million. What's the state share of that total? And as I understand, there was zero net to the stadium. How did that break down?
Mr. Barrett.
Yep. Mr. Chair and Representative, I think what you're alluding to is the tax value that's in there, and purposely we didn't bring any tax. We're not the revenue department. Our focus is just on what the charities do in terms of the activity. They're required to file their monthly report for tax purposes with the Department of Revenue. We'll take the opportunity with this legislation. There was a bit of tax reform afforded to the charities in light of this new gaming format, and those have changed in terms of the overall rates. But going back in time, I've tried to get rough, close estimates or as a percentage, if I may. Before the reform, on average, 4 cents out of every dollar spent on charitable gaming went to the state in the way of taxes. And I think if that's the might be less than that now with the new formulas, but I didn't come. I don't have any of the tax value associated. But, yes, they were reading as far as the value of the $15 million attributed to electronic. But the way the legislation was written, all forms of charitable gaming are under consideration when it comes to the funding mechanism, at least at the time the original legislation was passed.
Okay.
Representative Anderson.
One more, Mr. Chairman. I got a call last night from an irate person. He loves to play e-pull tabs. He spends a lot of money on them. And he was playing last night, and his machine locked up. And they called somebody down, put in some keypads, and got it going again. And he continued. He thought he was on a hot streak or going to get some big payoffs, and it locked up again. And then the control box behind the bar, which controls all of the units, also locked up. And he said, if you don't get that stuff fixed, I'm going to quit playing these games. So how reliable are these things, and are they getting better?
Mr. Baird.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. First of all, I'm sorry to hear there's that kind of a snafu, a problem. But I will take the opportunity in terms of our regulatory oversight and what this new technology affords us. In the old days with the paper games, we'd have to wait almost 2 months before an organization would file their monthly reports and we get that activity. We can see the activity in our office on the electronics almost instantaneously. So we could see what's going on. Now, if this was happened at night, we don't staff 24/7 that activity. Well, we show up in the morning, we do a run of all the activity that's going on. We'll see if each site is closed out, reported their value. In this particular instance, depending upon what happened, because we do know there's could be lightning strikes or interference that could interrupt that internet line. The nice element is if anybody were to lose connection and like everything, the data that's recorded, every transaction, the dollar in or the wager, is recorded. And so you can go back in a transaction log to recapture that data. So if the player was concerned, I didn't get the proper credits, all that data is available depending upon the time that, you know, the device went down. Now, something as simple as the battery life, if they don't pay attention because these are portable and not plugged in, but if the battery is draining, there's normally a warning to say, hey, you need to get the take the unit back to get charged up. But that's one of those things that we work with licensed distributors who work with the charitable gaming at that particular site. So if we have a problem site, there might be some interference coming across the internet line. That's where we take the action. But we're totally open to calls. Hey, this happened. And we've had calls. You know, I don't think it gave us the right credit on a win. We can go back, you know, if we had the right time and the device number, we can go back to that player and say, here's the detailed report for the time you were playing. The technology that's in front of us today as it relates to these devices is phenomenal.
You okay? All right. Any other questions for Mr. Barrett? Representative Devaney.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Barrett, as I scan the spreadsheet that you provided, it appears that people gamble more in the winter. Are folks drink more beer in bars in the winter and more beers at the lake in the summer? Or what am I seeing here?
Mr. Barrett.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dabney, no, that's very good observations. Historically, there appears to be a higher sales activity in the winter months. I wish the Vikings were still here because whether it's the Vikings or the Twins, but we can see a correlation between activity with major league sports. Sports continue in the playoff seasons, and representatives from Minnesota Licensed Beverage, kind of looking at the bars, will probably say the same thing. But we also see very interesting numbers. I go back to Porky's, 95,000 in August. That's a slow month, relatively speaking, but they've done very well. But you're right. We do see some correlation in the winter months as relates to charitable gaming activity, and I'm sure the bars would say the same thing.
Representative Dabney, any other questions for Mr. Barrett? Seeing none, thank you so much, Mr. Barrett, for all your work.
Thank you.
As articulated on the schedule or on the agenda, we want to schedule our next upcoming meeting. We said we probably wanted to get together in like 30 days. That will take us to November 5th. Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if there's, an argument to be made for a meeting in 2 weeks and then in 2 weeks again. And my thinking on that is the reports are coming out tonight. We to analyze those in a timely manner and give feedback to the authority in the November 1st deadline and then the mid-November deadline in terms of the Vikings financial commitment November 1st and the mid-November state financial commitment, that would give us, if we intersperse those meetings, I think we would address some of the concerns that were raised earlier about a more active role for the commission in the dialogue of shaping those agreements.
So to that, I am open to it, but it's my understanding that once the agreements are signed, pretty much what the authority could do is sort of go through what the agreements look like. But whether there would be any changes to the agreements at that time, it's my understanding no changes could happen at that time. So I'm always still open to doing whatever the commission wants. If we want to do something within 2 weeks so that we can have the authority go through those agreements so we know for sure what it says, and then follow up with another meeting in 2 weeks somewhere around November 5th or whatever, then at least we'll know if the Vikings got a chance to close on their documents and get an update from that vantage point. So what's the pleasure of the commission? Any other thoughts or ideas, Senator Sharon?
In addition to, considering maybe at least initially as activity is occurring, that we meet more frequently, I would prefer to have more than one meeting scheduled. I mean, I think it's an error for us to say, let's see if we can find a date where everybody can get here. I think that as chairs of the committee, you ought to establish a meeting date, a day, second Tuesday of the month or whatever it is, and that's when it is, and the rest of us have to accommodate to that. And if we can't do it right away, we will soon enough. But to ask an LA or somebody to go out and say, how many of you can meet on this day or how many on that day? If you can get here, you can. If you can't, you can't. But we ought to be scheduling this now, at least once every month, and maybe with an extra meeting this next time.
Okay. So with that, you have an idea as far as dates?
Well,
anyone in particular? I'm not putting you on.
I may ask Representative Reiner, if you would agree that it might be wise to establish a monthly meeting date first and then have some supplemental ones during this active time, if that would be agreeable with you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Reiner.
Thank you. Senator Sharon, yes, I think I like the idea of establishing a regular calendar date that we can put out for the next 6 months that we're going to meet on whatever, second Tuesday, third Wednesday, whatever we pick. And then I would still encourage us to have a couple of supplemental meetings over the next month and a half.
With that being said, is there any day during the week that works better for commission members, like a Tuesday or Wednesday in the afternoon or in the morning, so we can create a standing time as what has been suggested? Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I know there was quite a bit of effort put into scheduling this meeting. Thursday seemed to work for a majority of members, and maybe we don't want to overthink it, but grab Thursdays. Secondly, a couple of times, Tuesday, November 5th has been raised. I'd point out that's an election day.
Oh, yeah, that's
and,
true.
You know, first Tuesday after the first Monday, you recognize the pattern, Mr. Chair. And for some of us, including possibly the chair, that's important.
Yes, 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 something like that.
And lastly, as we look at a possible intermediate meeting yet in October, we do have the traditional fall school break coming up on a Thursday and Friday, and that might be a little bit more challenging for those of us who are parents of school-aged children.
So then can we start with maybe our monthly meeting? Let's start with Thursday seems to work well. You want to say the second Thursday in the month?
I just suggest you set it. Just I think you should just set it because there's always going to be some of us that aren't going to be able to make a meeting.
First,
so the first Thursday of the month.
Okay, first Thursday. That would be November 7th. We'll be the next meeting. Let me just put this in just so I don't forget.
1 o'clock?
Yes. 1 to 3?
Yes. That's fine.
And we could do the first Thursday of the month in November, December, January, and February during this time frame. But after February, we will be starting our regular session, so we may have to recalculate that.
Okay, great. And now with that being established, can we look at a supplemental date that's earlier than November 7th in order to meet in the spirit of Representative Briner?
Is 2 weeks from today MEA?
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Dabney?
may I point out that the Minnesota Education Association has not existed for about 15 years now?
Thank you.
It's a pet peeve.
Sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I would just say Minnesota is a state of traditions, and that's one that is not easily let go of.
It runs deep.
How about October 24th? Is that October 24th? That's a Thursday. Would that work for people?
So October 24th?
I would be agreeable to that.
Okay. Just make this phone operate here. I'm sorry. Thanks for your patience, because if I don't do it now, it's going to be a problem.